Welcome to the Talk BD podcast, where we break down the science and strategies to live well with bipolar disorder.
Sarah Slay, what a treat to start my Friday morning with you. The last time I saw you was a few weeks ago. It was at the International Society for Bipolar Disorders conference in Chicago. And we were both presenting a poster, and I wanted to get to see your poster, but there was such a big group of people around it that I didn't actually manage to get up to your poster during the event. Do you remember that?
We missed you, and I'd be happy to give you a private showing here if you come to Western Massachusetts. But Aaron, absolutely a delight and a privilege for me to spend some of my morning with you as well. I'm so grateful and in admiration of everything you guys do at Crest BD. So happy to be with you.
Oh, thank you for that. I do want to get to talking to you about Brainstorm, your film, but it would be a bit odd for us to start there. Let's go right back to the beginning. Would you grace me with your story of bipolar disorder and tell me where it all began for you?
Sure. Okay. Thank you for asking. So for me, I mean, we could go back a few generations, and it'll be interesting to talk about that maybe later. But in my experience, I was kind of cruising along as a high functioning kid, a senior year in college at Brown University. I had a 4.0 in science. I was going to medical school in the fall. I was varsity sports. I had a ton of friends, and then all of a sudden, for me, it was like, you know, the earth was pulled out from under me, and I felt like I was almost literally in a spiral crashing down to the planet. I had no kind of previous reference for what was going on for me. Suddenly, I couldn't add 2 + 3. I was confused about where I was, you know, navigation-wise. I was terrified to leave my room. I didn't want to see my friends. I started sleeping 12, 13, 14 hours, and my cognitive capacities were gone. And it was terrifying because nothing like this had ever happened to me before.
How old were you?
I was 21. It was almost literally my 21st birthday. It turns out that's pretty standard for bipolar to early incidents before 25. And that first depression lasted for about 8 months. And then I can go on from there and tell you more about my 20s, if you like.
Did you manage to carry on with your educational studies at that point?
You know, as it turned out, I was like 1 month from graduation, and I squeaked through because I had already finished all of my, you know, most of my required courses. I'd never gotten below an A, and I had a C minus in one course, passed and got out of there. If it had been earlier in my career, I'm sure I wouldn't have been able to. And later, I was actually, you know, as admitted to medical school, I took a year deferral, mostly because of this depression. And when I went back, I had another depression and I couldn't do it. I absolutely couldn't do the coursework. And so I ended up dropping out of school.
And so your earlier experiences were laced mostly with depression. Were you experiencing any of the highs of bipolar disorder at that point?
I did not. And quite honestly, I never have, except for what was induced by antidepressant medication, which we can get into later. I was, you know, I'm a high energy person, and you might say that's hyperthermic or hypomanic. I tease that everyone in my family is, but people will refer to me like, oh, Schley, she's going to get twice as much done as anyone else. So I have a lot of energy. It may be constitutional. It may be how I was trained in my family. It may be because of my bipolar genes. But I never really experienced, you know, a classic mania in any way. And thus the purpose of the book and ultimately the film to help people understand that there actually is bipolar without mania.
Mm-hmm. So how do things go for you after that? You're 21, you experience a long 8 month episode of depression. Was that treated at that point?
It was not. I went to a therapist, and so a little bit about my family history, which is in the book. My mother had severe depressions. My grandfather had severe depressions. And there was a lot of stigma around that. And I was hell-bent on not being them, you know. So I did the sort of young person resistance to my mother's story. But also, so she told me, she said, I'm sure, you know, she's probably heartbroken when I think back on it. Younger than I am now, she came to my college and said, you probably got the family disease. And I resisted that. Nope, not me. So because I was nothing like her, in quotes. So I did everything else except, you know, try to get this thing diagnosed and medicated for many, many, for decades, actually. I went to therapists and I did a lot of the kind of health behaviors that we'll talk about a little more probably later that are super helpful. But in the end, when I finally got my diagnosis, it was clear that I needed medication to get stable.
So when did that happen? At what point did you get your diagnosis of bipolar disorder?
25 years later.
Are you serious? So, 25 serious, years.
25 years, yeah. It turns out the average diagnostic time for someone with bipolar 2 or on the bipolar spectrum is 11 years or more. Mine was 25, partly my own resistance, partly that. So I took a while to get to a psychiatrist. I didn't really want to go to a psychiatrist. When I finally did, it was 5 psychiatrists and 7 medications before I finally got what I see the diagnosis saved my life, which was bipolar Roman numeral 2 on the bipolar spectrum. I was prescribed, you know, bipolar medications, in my case, Lamictal, which is lamotrigine. And I got better and I stayed better for quite some time.
Sounds like there's a lot that I'd like to hear more about in that five psychiatrist journey in terms of actually getting the precise diagnosis of bipolar disorder. How was that experience for you?
Well, you know, again, in retrospect, it's why a big part of the reason why I wanted to write the book was that it's kind of shocking to me that the first 4 psychiatrists didn't know. Because if you have a lens, if you're a psychiatrist or a person, Aaron, you'd probably be able to diagnose it with, I'm sure you would, with a, you know, expertise or even a kind of a cognizance that this bipolar spectrum exists, then you know the right questions to ask because you're looking for it. And then it's not that hard to diagnose. However, if you've not been trained and you're not looking, or you went to psychiatric training 20 years ago and you haven't continued your education, you didn't go to the ISBD conference, you don't know to look. So I walk into your office and I look depressed. I am. I'm horribly depressed. And, you know, and every manifestation that you can think of, clinical depression, lethargy, you know, suicidal ideation, no joy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the person who doesn't have the kind of educational framework to look for bipolar, as just mentioned, she's depressed. Let's give her an antidepressant. So I was given antidepressants, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different things. You know, Lexapro, Prozac, Wellbutrin, Effexor, I don't remember all the names, which made me worse. So then when you go back to that doctor who thinks you're depressed, they give you more of that drug or another drug like it. And you're still getting worse, but you can see their mental model is she's depressed. Let's give her depression drugs. And so it turns out, we come to find out that for some people, quite a few people with bipolar, antidepressants can be dangerous for our brains. I used to say poison, but then my psychiatrist friends don't say that because it worked for some people. For my brain, it was not good. And it actually triggered a kind of hypomania, which ended up being diagnostic for the guy that I went to, the 5th one, who was an ISBD psychiatrist. In other words, he had dedicated himself to understanding the complexity of bipolar.
So interesting. So what would those questions have been? You said if, you know, clinicians were really fully trained and keeping a high radar for bipolar disorder in addition to major depression, you said that there were some key questions that would have helped. What would you say to one of those early clinicians that you were working with that would have been a good question to ask you?
Yes, please. Or my first 4 or 5 therapists, a few of them who apologized in tears because they didn't know about bipolar 2. Or your primary care doc. Well, so my guy, Dr. Perlman here in Western Mass, he used Dr. Jim Phelps' book, Why Am I Still Depressed? And Jim Phelps is a mood spectrum expert who everyone should find out about and go to his website, psycheducation.org. But Dr. Phelps published in that book something called the BSDS, Bipolar Spectrum Diagnostic Scale, which is also on the website and also free to the public and also on my website resources now. And so it's pretty simple, but profound, because it was designed to help suss out bipolar without extreme mania. Mm-hmm. So my guy says, you know, basically, how many depressions have you had and how long do they last? And when you have them, are you extremely, you know, hyper, too much energy or not enough energy, too much sleep or not enough sleep? So questions about the type of depression. Do you have family history? Yes, my mother and my grandfather. How is it that the previous psychiatrist did not ask? Unbelievable, really, because as you know, bipolar is one of the most inheritable psychiatric diseases, I think the most. Did you have your first onset before age 25? Yep. And then I think the key question is, and when you were given antidepressants for your depression, did they make you worse or hypomanic? And I said, well, yeah, I think my husband said I started to get hair trigger temper and I don't have that. So he goes, okay, we know what you have. Chick chock. Here's this medicine. Stay the course. You're going to get better.
Yeah. What you're talking about is the importance of integrating screening tools into everyday practice and sort of, you know, the principles of what we would call measurement-based care. And many physicians and clinicians are super busy, like we all are. But what you can do potentially is give people one of these short screeners before they come into your therapy session or your clinical session. And then you've got that information in hand.
Absolutely. So short. And, you know, fast forwarding now, and we can talk about the film more later, but we're interviewing two Australian guys you may know, Dr. Michael Burke and Dr. Phil Mitchell, amazing human beings. Yeah. And Phil Mitchell has this depression diagnostic, types of depression scale. And so now it's later and I've already been diagnosed, but they say, okay, when you're depressed, are you more, do you need more sleep or less, more food or less, more energy or less, sports or no? I said, check, 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 not enough energy, too much sleep. They said, okay, you're bipolar too, you need Lamictal. I'm like, what? How did you do that? They have a depression scale. Because people who are hyper when they're depressed, you know, can't sleep, anxious, that's a different type of, you know, issue. So point being, there really are diagnostics out there that everyone should have. And like you said, even if you're a doctor who's like super uber busy and you can't figure out the time, have people fill it out or have the spouses or the partners or the friends or the kids fill it out in the waiting room.
So we've talked about the importance of measurement and we've talked about the importance of medications. Is that it? You got your diagnosis, you got your medications, was your work done?
No, ma'am. No, no, not at all. Not enough. And I think this was my, like, you know, 18-year-old self's kind of rebellion against my mother because that's all she did was the medication. I'm like, you got to get up. You got to work out. So I have, I did not create this, but I put it in a diamond. Holly Swartz, Dr. Holly Swartz and Tricia Supes told me that, well, there's really four things. There's medication, there's therapy, there's your support network, and then there's all the behaviors around that you are empowered to do. And so I think of that as a diamond and we need all four. Don't always need therapy once you're stable, but when you need it, yeah, I have my therapist on call, basically. She's amazing. I'll tell you a little story. My husband, he's great now, but he had a cancer diagnosis 3 years ago and I'm on an airplane. I text her from the airplane. She said, I'll see you at 8 a.m. You know, like that, like having someone in your corner. She says, because you're patient number one, because she knows about my bipolar. So anyway, so therapist, if you need support network, that's your friends. And we could talk all about what I call the emergency mental health team. And then all the kind of ancillary behaviors around diet, exercise, when you let light in your eyes, when you don't, et cetera. So I can share more about that.
Tell me more about that last piece. You're talking about self-management
behavior. Yeah.
And activities. What works for you on the ground with how many years of experience is it you have in your pocket with this condition now?
You know, I got to get my age, right? Because if you add 21 plus 41,
lots of experience.
It's fine. Four decades. But I wasn't, you know, I wasn't as, I learned along the way a lot of this stuff and I wasn't as rigorous about it because I didn't know the risks. Now I know that I believe these things are preventive. I don't think they're sufficient. I do think I need my medication as well, but I think the practices are really preventive. So I'm very disciplined. And people who don't know why, man, you're disciplined. And I'm like, yeah, because you don't know what's on the other side if I don't do this, right? It's to me, the other side when I'm in a bipolar depression and flare is so terrifying that I'll pretty much do anything to prevent that, right? So I came up with an acronym. I like acronyms and models. I used to be a consultant. I can't help it. Everything is three or four. So what I call it PECS, flex your PECS, and it stands for physical, emotional, creative, and spiritual, four things. And I try to do some of each day or some of each in a week. And I don't want to overwhelm people if you're just starting because this has evolved over a lot of years for me and now I'm old and I can do what I want. So. You know, so I have more control of my time, but I have become, you know, super disciplined about these practices. So I can go into them in detail if you want, but
I would love to hear an example for, that works for you on the ground of each of
those. Okay. So I think, you know, if I could pick just a couple, I would say the first thing is like the morning practice, whatever it is that you do. I that's in under spiritual and also under physical because I do yoga. So it's like starting your day in a way that's calm. Because I could tend to go, you know, just in terms of energy and, you know, having a lot on my plate and or getting overwhelmed or getting stressed. So I think that having the yoga replace the morning coffee, and I've been doing yoga for a long time now, 1989, almost every day. And having a like a discipline to like not open the computer and start doing emails, but first starting with like that presencing or breathing or centering, stretching. It doesn't have to be that long, you know, 15 minutes. I mine's now 30 because I have all kinds of PT that I do too. Over years, you get injuries. And then if you want to keep doing the aerobics, physical therapy. Yeah. So I do all my PT while I'm also doing my yoga. But so I usually take about 20 minutes or so. So I think that's really key.
Is it important for you to do it at a similar time each day? We know that circadian rhythms, body rhythms are really important in bipolar disorder. And we know that lots of things help stabilize our body clocks. Light's the key one. But beyond light, we know that social contact, exercise, doing them at a fairly similar time each day might be sort of incrementally helpful. Do you find that with your yoga practice? Do you try and keep a schedule to that?
It's always first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
So I think the answer is yes. And I think I did that before I knew about circadian rhythms, which I now understand what you're saying, Aaron, as well. But I think in retrospect, that helped because I always start that steady every morning ritual. And I have wherever you are in your house, try to have a space. Like I have a yoga mat. So wherever that yoga mat is, you know, that's like my sacred space and you don't mess with it. The dog doesn't get on it. You know, when the kids were little, they knew they couldn't get on it.
Dogs would chew my yoga mat, I think.
Then roll it up and don't let them on it. So I think, yeah, that's true. And I think the second thing that's essential is aerobic exercise. Everybody knows that, right? That just getting out and moving your body, whatever you do. I'm kind of addicted to, I have to do. So I usually actually do that also before work if I can, because I know once I get into my work day, it's harder to get tired in the afternoon. Different people have different needs around that. I just try to do yoga and then it's a hike or yoga and then it's a swim and then I'm good to go.
And then the emotional piece, how does that, the emotional stability piece, how does that work for you?
For me, I'm emotional social. I'm thinking about actually being with real people, not only like we are now, which is lovely, but actual real people, you know, real friends. So every day I look for where am I going to get that emotional social contact? And a lot of times I plan a walk with someone else because then I'll have that. I get my walk in and I also had my connection in, and that's perfect, you know, to be efficient. When I was just starting to get better after my last episode, I was very intentional about making sure that I had somebody to walk with every day because it would be hard to get out there on my own.
Yeah.
And one of my cousin is a psych nurse. And she said at that point, she said, you don't want to have any morning when you don't know what you're supposed to do because it start to, you know, it'd be easier to get depressed. So have a date. And I found that was helpful. Yeah, is helpful. I don't have to do that every morning anymore, but presently, because I've been well for some time. But I do have my standing walking dates.
Mm, your buddies.
My walk buddies, yeah. I call it sometimes brain buddies. And then there's water, Aaron. Time to drink a little.
Hydration.
Okay, time for us to have a little drink.
And then you haven't talked about the spiritual piece. Oh, no, you talked about the spiritual with the yoga. It was the creative piece that I wanted to hear more of.
That is, I think doing anything that, you know, basically probably gets you off the computer and email. It's whatever connects you to something a little bit more expansive. It could be dancing or cooking or singing or gardening or something with an ing probably. That just, you know, allows your heart. I can't remember. I think it's more right brain than left brain. It puts you in a different brain set. For me, like I love to sing. When I was getting out of my last depression after my mom passed, my neighbor like abducted me to chorus. And I love that chorus because it was community, it was social, it was singing. And there's all kinds of stuff around singing and where your brain waves align and it gets you a little bit high in a good way. It lifts your endorphins and lifts your mood. So I joined the chorus. That's been 8 years. Nine. Yeah. And spiritual, I do have to say one thing about spiritual because this would be a different podcast and we'll get into it. But I do unplug for one day a week. It's part of my spiritual practice, and I think it's absolutely brilliant. And that's unplugged from, you know, technology to reconnect with nature, get outside, mm-hmm. be with family. Mm-hmm. I wrote a different book about that.
You literally wrote a different book.
Literally write a different book. It's much skinnier.
And it's called what? It's
much skinnier. Yeah, it's called Secrets of the Seventh Day. I'm Jewish, and I practice the Jewish tradition of Shabbat. Very not orthodox, very progressive version, which is basically, it's a whole other podcast, but I wrote it for a Catholic friend who said, I want to learn how you do it. Ecumenically based. It's basically unplug, reconnect, don't get on the computer and don't go to the mall.
We need to do a whole nother talk, BD, on that.
At some point,
I would love a deeper dive into those pieces as well.
I do think it's also been very helpful for my bipolar brain. Yeah. Because there's every 7 days is that rhythm. And I know it's coming and it calms me down. I do think that it's very helpful. Yeah.
So you talked about supporters a bit, friends and family. One of the questions we get a lot through Crest BD, through our annual Reddit Ask Me Anything, and through these events is, you know, what is the best way for loved ones, for family members, for friends to support people with bipolar disorder? What would you say to them if they're listening now?
You'd probably be surprised to hear that it's four things.
You like your threes and fours, don't you?
Well, because a friend of mine who's in marketing, he says three or four, no less, no more. People can't remember more than four. So,
yeah.
But I similarly, when my book first came out, people were calling me going, I feel like a deer in the headlights. I don't know what to do. You know, my mother, my cousin, my brother, what would you suggest? So I thought about it a little bit. And I know you know all these things, Aaron, but we'll just say them from my perspectives. The first one is reach in. Don't expect people to reach out. They won't. So, you know, you got to pick up the phone. You got to knock on the door. Because if you say, oh, call me if you need me, there's not gonna. Because they feel shame, they feel stigma. My brain in that moment is saying, you know, why should I be on the planet? Why would I waste their time? Why would anyone want to spend time with me? You're not going to reach out. So the people who want to be an ally need to reach in. So that's the first thing. And even I have to remember that. Like a friend of mine was feeling depressed recently, and I just said to him, I said, oh, you know, Paul, call me when you need me. And then I realized, no, he's not going to call you. So thing one. Thing two is, and I know you know this, but it's listen without judgment, just presence. Don't try to fix it. You can't. You know, people like, you know, my brothers are guys and they want to fix things and they're good hearted, but you're not going to be able to fix it. And that may be frustrating, but basically what you're doing is just showing up and you're accompanying this person with your love and presence. Mm-hmm. And that is huge because it's like they've been living in this island of isolation and despair, and you're showing up as like a lifeline. So you can't imagine how powerful that is just to be present. Go for a walk. Don't even say anything. So that's the other thing. But then for the people who can't, they really can't do that because they've got to do something.
It's hard thing to do.
Right? Okay, you have things to do. Because then I say just do it is number three. Because we can get into this more, but for me and other people like me at this point, the brain is not capable of doing stuff, the simplest tasks. So it's like you do the laundry, you fill the freezer, you pick up the kids, you make the phone call to the doctor. They can't find the phone number. You drive them to the doctor. They won't be able to figure out how to get there. So the very simple cognitive things that you think, of course they can, they can't. I describe in a TED talk I did this like situation. I'm in the aisle of a grocery store and there's four peanut butters and I'm completely overwhelmed and paralyzed because I can't figure out how the frick to pick which peanut butter. You know, there's too many variables. It's overwhelming. So I need somebody else to pick the peanut butters.
Yeah.
So that's the third thing. And then the last one is you have to create a posse, a support team for you, because you cannot do this alone. It's too much for any one person. You'll burn out. Yeah. But then the good news about that is you have community. You build community amongst the folks who are helping. And the next day when one of you needs it, the community is there.
I love that. I also really love the way that you're encouraging people to think about what depression is as a beast. You know, it's a trickster. It lies. It really helps us lie to ourselves in terms of the way we understand the world and our cognitions. And then I also liked the way that, you know, you really, you know, nailed how much cognitive impact with the peanut butter example depression has. I mean, peanut butter is peanut butter. You would have, you know, your usual undepressed brain would be like, it doesn't matter. Walk out with some peanut butter. If it's crunchy or smooth, big deal. Right. The depressed brain is like, it's the biggest issue in the world is the peanut butter.
Right. And then you're flooded with shame because you're in public and you can't figure it out. Yeah. Or, you know, in the house, you can't do dishes. They pile up. You can't do laundry. It piles up. And then there's a whole bunch of shame associated with that. So you don't want people to come over, but you need them to come over because you're desperate for company. It goes on. And it's really terrifying. I mean, and it's just horrible because a lot of folks, we've done a bunch of interviews for the film, and it turns out people with bipolar typically are above high functioning average. That's the good news, like they, in terms of like capacity to get stuff done and cognitively. So for us, the delta is really huge. Like to go from being very high functioning to not being able to choose peanut butters, it's horrifying. And it's scary because you don't believe your brain is telling you you're never going to get out of it.
Right.
You don't think it's ever going to change. Mm-hmm. And you don't know if it's going to.
Yeah. And that's often where the risk of self-harm and suicide is, because it is so bleak and forever. And that's what your brain is telling you at that point, which isn't the truth, but it's very easy to believe at that point.
Absolutely. I contemplated it many times.
You talked about shame when you talked about stigma, and I'm just wondering what you've learned on your journey around, you know, society's representations of bipolar disorder, you know, how and whether you internalize that in terms of self-stigma and how you navigated through that.
It took me 40 years to come out and tell my full story in that memoir. And even when I did, my heart was pounding, you know, when I pressed send on publishing that thing, because for whatever reason, there was terror, you know, and I told my colleagues last because I was sure that I would lose my clients and lose my livelihood. And, you know, the stigma, why? I mean, I don't know, the association with bipolar, that people are crazy, that they're untrustworthy, that, you know, they're going to end up in the gutter, that you can't rely on them to follow through. So therefore, they wouldn't be good as a business colleague or client or et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. It was way internalized for me. And I'll say I didn't even realize how much I had internalized it until I did publish the book. And people who didn't know about my disorder, because folks who knew were my friends and family. But all those at that next circle out, and even some of the friends back from college and stuff who I never told. First of all, like, oh my God, I never would have known. You don't seem bipolar. And then as if it's a horrible thing, which, it, you know. But they also, there was a wave of love that came to me around, you know, thank you so much for your vulnerability. Thank you so much for your sharing. Guess what? My closet, my mother, my sister, my brother, my cousin. I can't imagine how many people had that story. And so my sharing gave them permission to share. And the love I felt, I just realized I was like, this is melting off the shame over time. Like, oh, wow. This, you know, it somehow, again, I didn't realize how much stigma I had been carrying. And then it got better. You want to know when it got better?
Yeah.
even more was when I met your pals. Like when I started meeting people who also live with bipolar and were willing to talk about it, General Greg Martin, David Kubushan, Dr. David Kubushan, Paul English, and could go on. They're probably all characters that you're going to interview if you haven't already. These incredible human beings. You know, one is the acting Surgeon General of California. The other guy commanded 10,000 troops in Iraq. The other one sold a company for $1 billion with a B. And I'm like, oh, this is a club I'll be part of. You know, I started having this reflection of not what you see in the media, in movies about, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or something. But people who are really high functioning, interesting, creative, oh, that's a different reflection. So I feel like stigma's been melting off.
That was the thing that stuck with me from what you just said. I mean, you said lots of amazing things in there, but that love melting the shame over time, that imagery was really powerful for me.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been great.
You culminated this story in a memoir. What was it called?
Can I show it?
Yeah.
Is that all right? Because I like the cover. I love this cover. Now let's see. Oh, it's maybe too bright for you to see.
For those of you who are joining on the podcast, there's a butterfly. Is it a monarch? Is that a monarch?
Yes, a monarch butterfly. It looks like lightning and a big storm, and then it becomes a blue sky. It's called Brainstorm, with the double entendre on purpose, with a capital S, Brainstorm, from broken to blessed on the bipolar spectrum. And I, you know, I am a writer, I love to write. And so that was a good process. And that in itself was healing. I have to say, because I write in community, I don't write alone. I write in a women's circle. A circle can be men too. It happens to be women. And this one woman, Mara Bright's been there every week for 20 years. I have these things that I repeat. And I started writing the book. Why did I write the book? This one of those therapists that I told you was in tears. They had no idea that bipolar 2 existed. They send their people with depression off to hike a mountain or to, you know, go to chorus. They don't know they need medication. They think they don't. You know, they don't have any idea. So she, at one point, her jaw drops and she says to me, "You need to write a book. My colleagues need to know this." Now, this was back in 08 when people knew less than they know now, because it's 15 years ago, but still people don't know. And so I talked into my voicemail and had 15 chapters on the ride home outline. And it was very cathartic for me to write, because writing can be cathartic, particularly witnessed by loving people. So I'd write and cry and write and cry and write and cry. It was healing. But yeah, so it's a story. It's a memoir. I started out just writing, wanting to write enough about bipolar 2 that people would understand about the misdiagnosis. You can have bipolar without mania, et cetera. My editor, wonderful, brilliant Jennifer Margulies, she says, "Nope, you got to make it a full story about a person. You got to tell them who you are, tell them about your childhood, tell them about your kids, tell them, you know." So I made it into a memoir. And people say it's really good. Mostly Jim Phelps and Holly Schwartz, these doctors who we know from ISBD, really gave me a lot of encouragement, because it's the first person narrative on bipolar 2 that's been needed, they said. Mm-hmm.
And so you didn't just write the book. There are some next
beyond that. Yeah.
Tell us more about what's happening now.
Again, some of these guys say, "Well, this is because of your bipolar personality. You just keep going." But so I have a wonderful friend from college. Her name's Bonnie Walsh. She's a science documentarian. She had come out with a brilliant film on climate change. And my other career before all this, I was a sustainability consultant for years and years. So I knew a lot of people who tried to explain climate change. Bonnie, I thought, knocked it out of the park. It was so good. It was so accessible to people, the whole feedback loops. And it was brilliantly written, animation, et cetera. And I thought it was fabulous. She had an early copy of the manuscript when it was before it was published. She really loved the book. And at like a, you know, it's just a social gathering, I sort of jokingly said, "Hey, Bon, can we make," because her Earth Emergency, her climate film, had just been aired nationally on PBS, which is a big deal, not easy to get, US PBS. And so I said, "Can we get a PBS documentary for Brainstorm, you know, about the bipolar spectrum?" She said, "Well, you can't just get a PBS documentary. You have to just make the best film you can and then try to pitch it to them. But let me ask Melanie." So who's Melanie? Melanie is a 40-year senior producer at Nova, the science series out of PBS, Nova out of Boston. And Melanie at first was like, "No, I think bipolar's been done." But then she read the book and she saw the TED Talk and she listened to the book and she said, "This is a story that needs to be told, because the bipolar spectrum story is not known." So she got on board. And then we're like, "Okay, we're going, but we need some funding." And then we got a beautifully generous anonymous funder who is interested in this work. And we were kind of underway at that point. So its intention is to, it's inspired by my memoir, but not about me. Its intention is to illuminate the bipolar spectrum by telling compelling stories of these characters we've just mentioned and more who live with bipolar to end this, crush the stigma, but also interweave that with cutting edge science. That's Bonnie and Melanie's wheelhouse. So that we've interviewed 36 bipolar experts around the world now. And that's growing. And we have, you know, 5 or 6 core stories, which I know you know them. And our interest, my aspiration is that this be very useful to people living with bipolar and their loved ones. So I don't want to just do science that's, oh, that's cool. I mostly want to do science that translates into things that people can do, have agency to implement in their lives. For example, the whole thing on circadian rhythms.
Yeah, that was going to be my question for you. You know, let's go forward to, well, what are the timelines? Maybe 2 years from now and think about how would the world look different after Brainstorm, the film, is released? If it was as successful as you would want it to be, how would the world look different?
Oh, I love that question. That's the kind of question I would hope someone would ask. I hadn't really thought about it too much. But all right, so we say we want high aspirations, right? Because when you do vision, you just go to the moon. Transform the landscape of bipolar as we know it. So A, people would understand it. We would have crushed the stigma. People would know that there's a bipolar spectrum. And therefore, there can be bipolar without mania. So if your friend is depressed and nothing's working or antidepressants make them worse, oh, there's a bipolar spectrum. Let's check that out. That loved ones would and people living with bipolar would have hope if they're still in a place of not knowing what's going on. And then people who, you know, once they get their diagnosis or even before, they can see where they have agency to really make a difference in their lives, like around the PEC stuff. So we've learned about circadian rhythm. So I'm saying, okay, kids being me. Okay, kid, you got to get to bed at 10. You got to get up at 6. It's going to be 10:30. Then it's going to be 6:30. It's important that you get up at the same time every morning, set your alarm. You know, okay, no light after a certain amount of time. I should have them here. Put on your amber glasses. The amber glasses filter out the blue light. So this may be more information that people can pull in one podcast, but again, a lot of the stuff is on Jim Phelps, psycheducation.org, and probably on CrestBD. And, you know, there's the microbiome, so making sure you have gut flora diversity. And there is the whole piece around exercise. So there's a lot we can do. So I want people to get that.
I love that. And I love that we've come together. We were introduced by Dr. Holly Schwartz, who's involved in Brainstorm the film and is just a phenomenal human being.
Unbelievable human being.
She brought your work together and our work at CrestBD together. I know that you're interviewing and talking to a bunch of people in our community. So just that this has happened, you know, you could call it synchronicity. You could say that we were just, you know, it was just the time for these groups to come together and to collaborate. And
Well, I have to thank you, Aaron. You introduced us to amazing people who are going to be in this film. Like, I'm pretty sure Sherry Johnson from you, is that right? And so many others that I can't remember all of them, but the whole positive side of bipolar, that Sherry's research showing, again, crushing the stigma to some degree because of the upside. I don't mean upside in terms of manic. I mean the positive side of features that we have. And those people introduced us to other people. I don't know if you knew Steve Hinshaw. Yeah. Steve Hinshaw was amazing. And then Steve Hinshaw introduced us to Kay Jameson. Mm-hmm. So we owe you for the opportunity that we had to interview Dr. Jameson. Of course, is, you know, instrumental and fundamental in with her work. Her memoir, An Unquiet Mind, inspired me to write mine. She read mine, said it was good, said it was great. That made me happy.
It should.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about bipolar disorder. I mean, we don't want to do disservice to the fact that this is a dangerous, potentially life-threatening, extremely, exquisitely hard condition that can be very serious. But the other side of that is that, you know, health and quality of life is within reach for many or most people, and that there is this amazing global community that is leaning in shoulder to shoulder to advance systems of care, to think about how to help people achieve full quality of life and really flourish across different disciplines, different types of science. And really core for us is putting the lived experiences of the condition at the heart of all of that.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Erin. I think you've been a champion and a leader in it. Because, let's hear from people who have lived through this, right? So I appreciate you centering our voices. That's been really awesome. Yeah, and it is an incredible community worldwide that something about this bipolar community, both of people with lived experience and people who are researchers and clinicians that are just awesome, generous. You know, out of I think 40 people now that between you and Holly and Jim Phelps have introduced us to, and then they've introduced us to others, only one said no. No, we're not going to. We should probably out them. But every other person, like within an hour, amazing. Happy to help. You know, so that's been lovely. Yeah. Around the globe.
So where do people learn more about Brainstorm the Film if they'd like to take a deeper dive?
Thank you. There is a website called brainstormthefilm.com. And there it's going to show, there's a list of our experts, which is everybody we've interviewed. And then that you're on there, Erin. And then there's a double click onto their websites. There's a list of our team, which includes Holly Schwartz and Dr. Jim Phelps, me, Bonnie, Melanie, Greg, and Dr. David Kabushan. And then there's sort of our vision, and there's a link to my book, but you can also, there's also a link to the resource page on my website is sarahschley.com for the book. And one of my friends, Stephanie, said, hey, when people search for this book, they're going to need help. You better put a resource page on there. Mm-hmm. And so I asked your people, Chris BD, Emma Morton, what are your resources? And she gave me a whole bunch. So probably all the resources you have too. But that way, if people are, you know, needing help right away, it's there.
Right. Well, make sure we put all those in the show notes as well. What an invigorating time that was talking with you this morning. I can't wait to see the next steps for all of this. I have a feeling that you and I will have lots of these conversations to come.
Oh, I sure hope so. That flew by, Erin. You're amazing. I don't even, it feels like 5 minutes. Thank you so much. No, this is great.
Thank you.
And thanks for your work. Really amazing.
You too. Ditto.